Markets do not serve the poorest of the poor. And the most important problem that I see in the world is that for about a billion people in the world who are at the absolute bottom of the world's material well-being, life is so disastrous that it is a gross exaggeration to say that they're living at the edge of subsistence, because they're dying by the millions of their poverty every year. This is a documentable, absolutely rigorous fact. People are not just living at the edge, they are falling right over the edge by the millions. You mentioned Bono. Bono is, by the way, not just a celebrity, but one of the most substantive people I've ever met. And I happened to be with him about 10 days ago in a trip through Africa, where we saw things that I never could have imagined seeing and never want to see again. We went to Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Blantyre, Malawi, which is the major hospital in that country, which is one of the most impoverished places in the world. And we were taken to the medical ward. About 70% of the people in the medical ward now are AIDS-related patients. But patients is a euphemism. There are no drugs in the clinic. So this was a room of dying people. It wasn't that every bed was filled. It was that every bed in the entire ward was filled with two people in the bed and one or two under the bed. They're running four to a bed. On a good day, it's three to a bed. Hundreds of people were packed into the room dying of AIDS. Now, of course, you know that calamity. But what you can't fully appreciate until you see the unbelievable character of it is that across the hall from that ward was the outpatient service, where for the tiny percentage of the public that can afford $1 a day for the drugs, people are under treatment. Their health is restored. They are back at work. They are tending to their children. Their children have mothers and fathers. And yet across the hall, for a lack of a dollar a day, we're throwing away human beings. And we're doing that by the millions right now. And when you go out from the hospital into a village, few miles outside of the city, you see another sight you'd never believe could be true. The villages are orphanages. There were no working-aged adults when we went. There were a few grandmothers who, through translators, told us the story of how their four or five or six children had died of AIDS, leaving them with 10 or 15 wards to look after their grandchildren. In mud brick houses, where what the social services can manage is perhaps to get a plastic tarp under the thatched roof to stop it from raining relentlessly all through the night. Now, the shocking part of this is that it would be so easy to address. For 2 years, I chaired a commission for the World Health Organization looking at the conditions of health of the world's poorest people. We found that 25,000 people per day in the poor countries are dying of preventable or treatable conditions because they lack a few bucks to get health care. It's malaria, it's AIDS, it's TB, it's things we have the drugs for. But we're talking about the poorest places in the world. Markets don't serve the poorest of the poor, especially the sickest of the sick among the poorest of the poor. So what you can ask, and what I'm trained to do as a macroeconomist, is to add up the costs. What would it actually take to address this? And it turns out that if all of us in the rich world set aside one penny for every $10 of our income, one penny for every $10, since the rich world is a $25 trillion a world a year GNP, one penny out of every $10 would mobilize $25 billion a year, which our estimates showed, when combined with the efforts within these countries themselves, could save 8 million people a year. Now, I just left the World Economic Forum, where the last panel had a senior official from the State Department, who was asked by somebody in the audience, what are we doing in today's budget asking for, is it $40, $50 billion? I haven't read the budget yet, but something like $50 billion increase on military spending to make us safe in a world of such vast inequality that we're not talking about unhappiness, we're talking about death by millions. Death by millions. And he said, oh, but we have a foreign policy that covers our security, but it also covers the other things. We're proud to be investing U.S. funds into a global fund to fight AIDS, he said. What is the administration proposing today? Again, if yesterday's press accounts are right, when the budget was released today, $200 million compared to $50 billion. Now, I've just done 2 years of the arithmetic. $200 million from the United States is a death sentence. Is a death sentence for millions of people. It is nothing short of that. That, to me, is the number one issue that we face for our generation. Can't we find a politics which leads us to one penny out of $10 to somehow translate into 8 million lives per year? And the answer so far has been no. I don't know your feeling about it. My feeling is not to give up on the American people. My feeling is they don't know how much they could do. The surveys show they'd be willing to do a lot. They think we give too much in foreign aid, but they think what we give is about 20 times what we actually give. So they say we should only give about 5% of the budget, which is precisely 10 times what we actually give right now. Because no president in 20 years, including the Democrats as well as the Republicans, have explained this to the people. So just to end, at least what I'm trying to do, what Kofi Annan has honored me by asking to help him do, is to make some of the basic facts known. Whatever else we have in the world, I don't think we want to live in a world where millions die out of our most callous neglect. And that's exactly what we have. Thanks.
I said a policy in this sense. When somebody's speaking, whoever's taking the most rapid, violent notes on paper, call them to speak next. And I noticed that Victoria, Don Dean, if you haven't filled a notepad, didn't fill a notepad there, then you'd be surprised. How do you respond to what Dr. Simon said, Jeffrey, let me say? If we're going to call you Victoria, we have to call him Jeffrey.
Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank Jeffrey also for raising that whole issue. That's an issue that's closest to my heart because I am a nurse by profession. And I've studied at a public nursing school in the Philippines, and that's exactly the reason, actually, why I really became an activist. When I was, I finished my nursing in 1976, and that was the time that we were still under the Marcos dictatorship then. And one day, I was handling a patient, a baby, who was just born, and we were trying to resuscitate the baby, and we could, the ambulatory bag that we were using had holes in it, and we cannot even put air into the baby's respiratory tract, because every time you press the ambu bag, air comes out all the time. And I was so infuriated, because at that time I knew that, you know, Imelda was having all this wealth, you know, building all these constructions, and we cannot even have an ambu bag, which is maybe less than 100 pesos, you know, which is like 20 cents or less, to even resuscitate the baby, and that baby died. For me, because after I finished school, I went to the villages and worked in my communities to do community-based health programs. And all of us, many of us, some of the doctors and nurses who opted to go into the villages to do it, the main findings that we have is that all of the diseases that we have are really highly preventable infectious diseases, which can be treated by better nutrition and even by very simple drugs like tuberculosis drugs, but people cannot even take hold of it. At that time, when I was in the villages, that was 1979-1980, our country underwent structural adjustment policies, and the government had to cut back on our health budget. And all of the, we used to have some free medicines coming into the rural health units, and all of the maybe more than 80% of the medicines cannot come in anymore because of the cut in the budget, and all the charity services in the hospitals, the government hospitals, had to be cut back because of structural adjustment. So I think it's really a serious problem. I totally agree that AIDS is a serious problem. Public health is a serious problem. But we should not forget that one reason why the budget that goes into these public health services is because of the IMF and the World Bank policies, the structural adjustment policies that they imposed on us. The second reason, And I can never forget the experiences I had. One time I had to hike like 17 hours a day to go to a village because we had to do vaccinations. And when we reached the village, the vaccines were, we cannot even use them because we didn't, you know, they were not, we cannot bring them in ice boxes. And then we found out that the all the vaccines that were there were also expired, because we suddenly got those vaccines from the WHO, and they just sent it to the villages because they were almost expiring. But by the time we went to the villages, they were all expired. So anyway, just to go back, the other thing about AIDS is that we all know that that really is a big problem. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why we campaigned so hard at the WTO, because of this whole trade-related intellectual property rights agreement, where GlaxoWelcome is producing AIDS medications, one treatment which costs $3,000 per treatment. And India was able to produce these drugs also, and they can sell it at $170 per treatment. And they were threatened to be sued in the WTO court because they cannot sell that, because GlaxoWelcome has the patent over these drugs. And I think this is really the greatest scandal for me, that a pharmaceutical company has that, I mean, can sue a company, small pharmaceuticals who can produce the AIDS drugs simply because they want to get profits, and the AIDS patients who are dying each hour, each day, cannot even get access to these medicines because of that expensive amount of, you know, that expensive money that you have to pay to GlaxoWelcome. I think that really is something that has to be addressed by governments, by the international community, by WHO. And fortunately enough, in Doha, many of the, it was because of the AIDS activists from South Africa, from all over the world, and also the NGOs who are supporting, that we managed to bring in the TRIPS and Public Health Declaration in Doha, which says that governments are have the right to not to exercise, you know, not to adhere to intellectual property rights agreement if their public health requires them to do so. And that was not an easy struggle. It has been a long struggle because the countries who have the pharmaceuticals have really been very strongly opposing it, specifically some of the Swiss companies. And in fact, in Doha, up to the last hour, the Swiss government, backed up by their Swiss pharmaceuticals, were trying to have their very best not to have that agreement come into the table. So I think we are really very much concerned about the AIDS situation all over the world. And that's precisely why we are appealing to these corporations to have control over the manufacturing of these products, to have a little bit of conscience, to even make their prices lower and not to sue those companies who can develop the drugs at a much lower price. And I think that really is something that we need to stress here, because it wasn't an easy battle that we got that in Doha, and it's not even a guarantee that if something like that comes again, they will some suit or a suit against these companies or against a developing country producing these drugs will come into WTO or in any other port. Thank you very much.
Now, we just heard from somebody who was inside the World Economic Forum and somebody who was down at the World Social Forum, essentially agreeing on a lot of the core problems and agreeing on a lot of the core points. So I still go back to this fundamental question of why we need a World Social Forum and a World Economic Forum. Where's the breakdown? Lori Wall, why don't you try and answer that question for us?
I'll follow on that, but I also want to pick up where the line of discussion is.
Please, I hope you will.
It's the same point, actually, which is, I think that we need to think about systematically why are those folks that you described as the poorest of the poor so very poor at this moment in time, and make the link with some of the resulting terrors, like the way the AIDS epidemic has ravaged Africa, with, I would say, that the World Economic Forum approach of trying to deal with the results is meritorious. I am for more foreign aid. I am for people being able to get access to antiretrovirals, and it's a scam of the pharmaceutical industry, etc. I'm all for that. But I would argue, and this is what even here at the World Social Forum, that you need to take a step back and look more broadly about the whole scenario. So let's just look at Africa. I mean, I do also recommend Mark Weisbrot's article about Globalism for Dummies, because he's a trade lawyer, not an economist. He finally made all the numbers there accessible to me. And what does the data show? The African countries who went through the International Monetary Fund structural adjustment, they reorganized their economies according to that model. That was supposed to be painful, but then make them grow and make them rich. Trade liberalization, finance liberalization, investment liberalization, deregulation, privatization, and new protections for property, the intellectual property protections that Vicky was talking about, and also investor protections. That formula was supposed to, if painful in the transition, ultimately be the thing that would create the wealth that would allow, for instance, a public health infrastructure, etc. And the data is exactly opposite. If you look at the period in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, prior to those adjustments, the growth rates are not great. But if you look afterwards, it goes from a not impressive positive growth rate to negative. 23% loss in per capita GDP in the period when the structural adjustments went into place and afterwards. Now, if you looked 5 years after it started, you could say, all right, it wasn't long enough, you can't judge. 20 years later, for those parts of the world to actually having had the bitter medicine, to actually have a worse condition. And it's not just the finance and investment stuff. In the WTO, the sub-Saharan African countries, in the 7 years that the WTO has been in effect, have seen their share of world trade decline. And if you look as well, not just literally at the wealth that's there to be able, either through the government or through individuals, to buy their way into that $1 a day, which so many people can't. But if you look also at the IMF's programs as far as cutting domestic spending did, and this gets to what Vicky was talking about the public health system. I mean, why was it when the AIDS crisis in the US was discovered, there could be a public education campaign that would talk about how to prevent the transmission of HIV? And for people who had HIV, obviously there were meds, but part of the issue was the infrastructure to do it. Versus in many of the countries that have been structurally adjusted, the public health services have been eviscerated. That was the first stuff to go. So a refrigerator at a hospital, forget that. Just a campaign to tell people about condoms would be something that no longer would be in a country's capacity, even though there were public health systems before. And then you start to look, just if you look at Africa and the AIDS and HIV issue, you look at a lot of the wrenching economic changes that occurred. And there are many studies, the New York Times just did a big series on this, about the link between economically driven migration, the social dislocations of globalization, breaking up whole regions, towns, villages, and then the migration and the pattern through the migration of HIV spreading, being brought back into villages, then the men leaving again to work as the local economies are basically destroyed. So if you call...
would tell you that economic globalization hadn't all been to the good. But is it really as bad as Laurie says?
Yes, I think it's worse, actually.
So Laurie's wimping out on us here.
Well, it's just what? I mean, it's not just Africa. And I think that's the thing. I agree that the poorest of the poor are the most important problem, people that are starving, and people don't have access to essential medicine. But you also have to consider that the entire low and middle, if you take the entire low and middle income countries, all of them as a group, they've lost out over the last 20 years. The rate of growth of income per person is less than half of what it was in the previous 20 years. So there's been a real failure of this whole entire model that's been pushed by Washington and the fund and the bank. And it really is, I think you'd have to agree with me on this, Jeff. It is a failure of the economics profession and a result of the politicization of the economics profession that you don't have people talking about this. I mean, if economists don't care about economic growth, who is going to? And this should be the question that's in the papers every day. What went wrong over the last 20 years? This is the worst economic failure since the Great Depression. And the most widespread. And, you know, it's true, Africa was hit the worst in the sense that they had positive growth of about 34% in the first, from 60 to 80. And, of course, if they had continued at that rate of growth, there would be at least some more means of treating people there, not in the very poorest countries, but in some. And then, of course, Latin America grew by 75% per person from 60 to 80 and has grown about 7%. Since 1980, and there it's very clear, you know, what kind of policies, some set of policies were introduced in the last 20 years. And 20 years is a long time, and this isn't an artificial cut, and Jeff will back me up on this too. This is a business cycle peak. You had oil shocks in both periods. This is a fair comparison. You could put the 50s in there, it would make it even worse. We just don't have data going back that far for everyone. So this is a clear phenomenon that's being ignored for ideological reasons, because the press and the economics profession, I guess I blame the profession more than the press, because the press really takes their lead from the economists on this, is not willing to look at any of the causes. Now, it was because of Jeff and Joe Stiglitz during the Asian financial crisis that the press had at least noticed that that crisis was actually caused and exacerbated by policies promoted by U.S. Treasury and the IMF. If they had not spoken out, that would have gone right by and would have been treated as another success like the Mexican, so-called Mexican bailout. I don't like to use the word bailout because mostly it's the people being thrown overboard, and it's the banks, as in the Asian crisis. All they really did was bail out the banks and make the governments of that region guarantee the private debt. And Jeff has written about this as well. So I agree with you and with everyone else here. I mean, you know, and I'm completely supportive of Jeff's project to try and get more foreign aid where it's most needed. It is a shame, It's a disgrace that the United States spends only 0.1% of GDP as compared on overseas development assistance, not foreign aid, which includes, you know, half of that is Israel and Egypt, and doesn't really go to, you know, to help people. It's, you know, it's political, it's military. And that's why I don't blame the people of the United States either. You know, they don't support foreign aid because they know our foreign policy is rotten to the core. Even if they don't know where Burkina Faso is, they know what we've done in the world. A lot of them lived through the Vietnam War, and they know it hasn't changed very much at all since then. We're still doing the same things in the world. We're making things worse. That's why my goal is even more modest than yours, I guess. We're trying for harm reduction, okay? We're trying to stop the United States from making the situation of people in Africa and Asia and Latin America worse. Right now, the IMF is in there negotiating, pressuring the Argentine government to back away from its program, which would have made the banks pay for the devaluation instead of the people, okay, $9 billion of European and U.S. banks. I thought that was going to go for sure. But that's now up in question even because the fund is pressuring them right now. Okay, right now it's secret negotiations. We don't even know what they're doing and how they're leaning on them. And they're pressuring them not to do the other things they wanted to do, tax the oil companies. So you can go through case after case and country after country, and Jeff has done this too. He's talked about it. And maybe you can't talk about it as much now, and that's fine, because you got a different project. You're trying to get these people to cough up some money, and I'm very much for them. But, you know, it took thousands of people in the streets, you know, ACT UP, Philly, to get the United States screaming Gore's greed kills, you know, a couple of years ago, to get the United States government to stop threatening South Africa with sanctions for their Medicines Act, which would have allowed them to import and produce generic equivalent of their AIDS drug. That's what we're dealing with. We're fighting them every inch of the way just to let people, just to let a decent government where it exists, or a rotten government that wants to pursue a decent policy, do what's best for their own people. That's what we have to fight every day.
Two quick housekeeping matters. Folks who are seated, please try to move in. The management of the church, and I don't know if that's God or somebody lower down the...
Rich countries have problems with poor countries. It's almost like everything else. So I agree with the criticism very much. I also agree that
can we pause for a second? You do agree with the point that economists have become too politicized, or with the broader point of
I was making a simpler point, okay, that they have neglected this issue. Okay. So they just haven't. They don't even spend time worrying about it. It's not that that they have some great wrong answer. They don't even know it's a question often. I think that's more of a problem, actually.
Do they care?
Well, they don't notice. They probably would care, but in general, development economics is a kind of sidelight to the economics profession. So I think there is a most of the economists go to financial markets or other issues involved with the U.S. economy. We're trying to battle that and point out that 5/6 of the world lives in the developing countries, so-called developing countries. The world is the developing world, not the developed world. That's the very odd one sense. And odd we are indeed. Let me say a word about the IMF, and then I'm going to enter into a point that probably will be a point of controversy, but I just want to do it for the sake of clarifying one big aspect of the debate. So far, I haven't disagreed with a word that I've heard, there's actually a tremendous amount of sentiment around here. The IMF structural adjustment era was a massive failure. This is not an ideological point, this is just a point in the data. There's no question about it. That era was a period from 1980 to 2000, roughly. It is over, actually. It's over because it was such a massive failure. You have the IMF managing director now, Horst Köhler, speaking almost every day, calling for vastly increased sums of assistance to help poor countries, saying that we can't go on like we were, cutting budgets at the expense of dying people. And I think this is extremely important. And it's also important to understand that the IMF for a long time was serving the purposes mainly of the US government, which did not want to face up to the lack of foreign assistance that we give. So when we told countries, tighten your belts, rather than looking at the scale of the emergency honestly, now there's a pushback. And the pushback is to tell the United States, you look at this honestly, without more assistance from the richest country in the world, you can't square the circle. There's going to be too much death and suffering unless there's much more help from the United States. Incidentally, for anyone that's interested in the health report, it's online for free at our website at Harvard, which is www.cid.harvard.edu. www.cid.harvard.edu. You can download the report, and I hope you will, because a lot of expert work from around the world went into it.
I want you to cause some controversy, but before you do, I want to do two quick things. Can you hold the controversy for
sure?
All right, good. Laura, you're going to say something quick in response to this? And then we've got poor Michael here, who's probably communicated more people on issues of economic globalization than any of us, sitting quietly and waiting. I appreciate that.
I wanted just to bring up a hot pursuit point about the IMF and their rethinking, because it should be from your mouth to God's ears if that is the case. But from what I can see, with what the IMF has to say about Argentina, we all better start praying. I mean, I don't see such a huge shift. I see more of the same stuff. And what's worse is for all the countries who signed the contracts to do the structural adjustment, that's flopped. I don't see the IMF running around saying, oi, what a mistake that was. Let's rip that up and start over. They're still around the neck by the same damn contract going down the tank. And that would be bad enough, except here's a moment to turn a page. And are they turning? They're going backwards with Argentina. And I just had to say that.
Michael, you have actually written more than anybody I know of about how these institutions can actually learn and be tweaked. You've written especially about the WTO, how it relates to green issues, environmental issues. We've got a little bit of a discourse on this panel about whether the IMF has actually learned anything. Let me ask you first off, how you've covered all of these institutions. How bad are they? How good are they? And to what extent can they be made better?
About
30 seconds.
Let me start at a slightly different point. My head is swimming from the generalities, and I think I'm losing sight of exactly what the question is. You've asked about a whole set of institutions, all of which have different cultures, different histories, do different things. And I guess my visceral reaction is that we're painting with an awfully broad brush, and I'm not sure that's necessarily useful. It's one thing to condemn the IMF. They're an easy target. It's also easy to condemn a lot of what the World Bank has done. I sense a spirit here that we're going to use the same instincts to begin to indict this term called globalization, and I guess that means trade, and I guess that means the World Trade Organization. I think you begin to get, I start with 2 points down. You've indicted the press and you've indicted economists, and I'm unfortunately not qualified in both categories. It's quite a hopeless exercise. But
redeem them both.
I guess one caution is a little humility here would go a long way. We don't know very much about how to get countries in Africa growing. We don't even know very much about how to get the U.S. economy growing very successfully. And I think one ought to be cautious about these broad indictments of institutions and theories and everything else along the way. Yes, Jeff is right that development economics is not the profession's proudest moment. It's actually interesting to think about why that's true. It's not because a lot of people haven't been doing it. It's not because a lot of smart people, smart economists, have not thought about it. It's that they've been spectacularly unsuccessful. And perhaps one of the reasons is that it's perhaps the most inherently political of all economic questions, in which the politics of economic advice is at the center of the advice and can't be relegated to some afterthought the way we do fiscal policy or monetary policy or a lot of even welfare policy, as odd as that's going to strike a lot of you, where the politics of the policy advice can be said, well, let the politicians handle that, but we have a lot to say about deficits and spending and setting time limits on welfare. In development economics, it just never worked. That the issue was just so inherently caught up with politics, you couldn't even say five sensible words. And therefore, at least in my generation, economists exited that field in droves because they couldn't use their math and they couldn't use their statistics and they couldn't get very far. That's reversing in some ways, and the profession has never honored people who did applied policy very much. And development economics has been about applied policy, and those people have never gotten the professional recognition for heroic attempts. I worry a lot about the feeling in this crowd that you can indict. Well, there's a lot of evidence in the economics profession that trade helps, that globalization can help poor countries grow. I don't want to overstate the case. I don't want to state the case that the, what's called free trade concept, I have no idea what it means, but liberalized trade is always good. It's not. People like Joe Stiglitz have compellingly argued that in many ways it's been destructive and certainly been pushed very hard. But I think to go from rejecting the entire breadth of findings of how good open market activities have been for getting growth started, a number of these studies authored by Jeff Sachs, to go from rejecting them with a flick of the wrist to the notion that it's all a sham and it's all a conspiracy and it's open trade and trade liberalization that's burying developed countries in their poverty, I think is making a gruesome mistake. The IMF, even the IMF mistakes are rather complicated.
Who said that, Mike? Because I haven't seen anybody say that.
You got to go with the mic, you're going to answer.
And I like you asking the question.
Because I really think that's important because people are always trying to portray, and that's why I don't use the word anti-globalization either. I mean, there was an article just in the New York Times, an AP article this week, and they said, the success of Porro Alegre was due to, ironically, to globalization, the cheap airfares, and to, more open borders, and the internet, and it said, and all these things that most of the anti-globalization activists, most of the people here are against, it said. That's almost an exact quote. And that was just such a caricature. You couldn't find one person in Porto Alegre who was against open borders, more open borders, the internet, or cheaper airfare. And we're not against trade or foreign investment. We're for countries doing what they want to do. We're the ones, you talk about humility, where do you see the left or the critics that you're referring to come up and say we have a formula for every country to follow, like the IMF does, that measures success by the degree of openness, regardless of what the consequences of that openness are? We don't do that. We want self-determination and democracy. That's our criticism of the IMF and the World Bank. The IMF is a creditor's cartel. We don't think that's legitimate. We don't think there should be a cartel. One organization gets to say, if you don't do what we want, you don't get money from the World Bank, from the IDB, from the G7, from USAID, and most of the private sector either. That's what we want to break up.
Can I stick my neck out and say that I'm also for democracy? I did not detect in your writings a careful distinction of the component of what you label the Washington Consensus of Liberalization. It was a broad brush rejection of it. But let me come back to the original question, which was, are these organizations hopeless? Let me talk about one, which is the WTO, and debates Gloria and I have been having, I don't know, 10 years of war since my days on the editorial board. I actually think the WTO has been surprisingly effective, successful, and constructive.
Listen.
I'm a journalist and economist. I'll get to make this.
That was a very quick and effective boo. That's how to do it. Now let's hear.
Now, of course, that the substance of that remark depends on what expectations I had when we started. Let me just refer to specifically, since I was asked about it, the WTO record on the environment, which is reflexively rejected, I'm sure, by everybody in this room. But I think it's a far more complicated and subtle history than is normally allowed. WTO is held responsible for a set of rules in which it said the United States policies were to be declared WTO legal. There are a couple such cases. Perhaps the most important one was Shrimp Turtle, in which it said that U.S. regulations, that said countries that collected, that caught shrimp with boats that needlessly killed turtles, sea turtles, that shrimp would be kept out of the United States. And the WTO did so rule, and the environmental movement, for the most part, was quite condemning of the ruling for obvious reasons. But in a pattern I won't go through because it would take an hour. If you look at that ruling and you look at other rulings since 1995, you will find something far more subtle and I think constructive and encouraging, which is in fact what the WTO appellate body ruled, the equivalent of the Supreme Court, if you will, was that the law that the United States passed was perfectly fine, that they were embracing the notion that the United States could pass laws that said, we're not going to take your products if they were produced in a way which we deem damaging to the environment, a principle that had never been established in international law before that. They did condemn the United States solely because they argued it was implemented in a needlessly discriminatory fashion, that it hurt the foreigners in ways and advantaged domestic producers in ways that were unrelated to the purpose of the law and could be gotten around by just non-discriminatory means. Lori and I can have hours of conversation about the quality of that ruling. But that and many other rulings, the WTO is staking out grounds that is giving a lot of leeway and a lot of room for countries under WTO law to protect the environment even beyond that which existed before the WTO came into being in 1995. There is case law now being developed, one case at a time, in which the environmental leeway of countries like the United States is being expanded one step at a time. It has now in many ways become a political battle, and that's exactly right, that organizations around the world are becoming organized, fighting within the WTO. WTO so far is a very closed organization. The most important thing to do is to open it up. I'm not a WTO fan. There's a lot of changes that have to be made. My point is the same point, which is don't condemn with a broad brush. There are things going on that are constructive. There are things that are remediable. There are things that can be improved. The WTO is one of them. We can go on and talk separately about the World Bank and the IMF. They are very different institutions.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm going to quickly grab Lori, because my reference for a great deal. Lori, I'm going to ask you to be very quick, if we can, only because I don't want to lose Jeffrey Sachs before A, causes controversy, and B, we ask him at least a question or something.
I simply wanted to point out, and we can't have this debate in all of its glory here, because everyone would fall asleep as we spoke in Gattese, but for anyone who would like a very different take, because there is a very different take, on the environmental record of the WTO, buy our book. It's right up there. Thank you.
She's right. It is very different. Double endorsement. Now, Vicky, Victoria, I'm not going to call on you because I got a pile of you were the winner of the question contest. You got the most questions. So we're going to get to you in a sec. Jeffrey, you're going to cause some controversy, I hope?
Yeah.
All
right. And then sadly, because things are just starting up, I'm going to have to.
Story good.
Okay. Where do we begin? First, I want to recommend a good book. Okay. By Angus Madison. It's called Monitoring the World Economy, 1820 to 1992. It's called Monitoring the World Economy. Angus Madison. If you're interested in a long history of what's actually happened in the world in data, sorry, but it's interesting. I found it, I assigned it the first day because it's got a lot of interesting numbers. And the point I wanted to make was the following, that Africa has been poor for 200 years in poverty. It's never grown rapidly. It's a terrible, tragic environment. And there are many questions why, but the burdens that it has faced from malaria, colonialism, the slavery, the period of slavery, and the heavy dependence on a few primary commodities in trade are all part of the story. Now, the IMF failed to change its Africa's basic dependence on primary commodities, even one iota. That's the most important failure of structural adjustment. There was no structural adjustment. Nothing changed. Africa did not get foreign direct investment. It remains as dependent on coffee, tea, cocoa, with all their declining prices and instability as it was 20 years ago. Africa barely gets foreign direct investment. Now, except for the oil sector and maybe diamonds and so forth. It does not export even textiles and apparel to the U.S.
Slaves.
I'm sorry?
Slaves.
Yes, and of course it was forcibly exporting slaves up until basically the end of the 19th century. Still, there's some slave trade going on today in Sudan and Mauritania and other places. But the point that I wanted to inject was that the other side we should look at, my biggest urgency is with the poorest of the poor. I think life and death is really our first task. There are lots of middle-income countries where the story is much more complex. Let me give you a few quickly. China has had the fastest economic growth in the world, in history actually, during the last 20 years. Korea, Taiwan, you know these cases, Malaysia, Singapore. These are all fascinating examples for us to understand because they've been rapid economic growth accompanied by massive improvements in social conditions with life expectancy rising to above 70 years, with sharp drops of infant mortality rates, with big increases of nutritional content of diets and so forth. In all of those cases, those countries were successful in generating new export sectors in manufacturers and attracting a tremendous amount of foreign direct investment. It's actually the most marginalized economies in Africa, for example, where no one goes except to drill an oil well or to dig a diamond mine, that are the worst of the worst. And the fastest growth has come for the economies successfully attracting foreign direct investment and able to increase exports like China has. China, you know, went from about $20 billion of exports in 1980 to $250 billion of exports last year. Every other shoe in this country is made in China, usually the left one, I suppose. But the point is that that export boom was sufficient to carry 1.3 billion people on a stupendously dramatic increase in material well-being. Now, to me, that's the point of controversy. I don't know if it's controversy because I like how Mark described it, mostly. But the point of for me as a strategist economically, I try to help countries attract foreign direct investment and stimulate exports, because not in the traditional sectors, because I don't believe you can get rich on sisal, jute, coffee, tea, but I do think that you can get rich on semiconductors. I do think you can get rich on automotive components, on plastics, on other, that sounds like the graduate, doesn't it? But wait, just to make the point, just so I can complete the point. My biggest worry in the world is for the countries that the investors aren't interested in at all. And what I believe on the economic growth side is that the key is to escape from this narrow group of commodities on which they live into a much more diversified base for material well-being. Then you ask the question, why don't they get that? Now, there are many answers. One is the trading system is biased against the poor countries. So why don't you actually make chocolates in Africa rather than just cocoa beans? The reason is there's a 26% tariff on finished chocolate into the European Union. So you make the chocolate in Europe, you sell the, and all you can do is import the coffee beans duty-free. So in other words, the trade regime works against the poor countries. It does in textiles as well. It does in many different areas. So that's one answer. Second is some of the poorest places in the world are geographically in extraordinarily difficult conditions. Companies other than for oil or diamonds don't go to landlocked regions generally. They don't go to mountainous regions. They don't go to faraway regions. They go to the coasts. And so this is an important point. They don't go to malarious regions in general. Even disease can be a major hindrance. So there are many reasons why different countries are not yet successfully in this game in the right way, I would say. And finally, the IMF gives bad advice on how to attract foreign investment. You'd be surprised, actually, how bad the advice is. It's just not clever. They tell countries wrong things, and the advice and the investment goes to countries not under IMF programs, but under to the rest of the countries. So there's a matter of bad advice also. The point I want to make, though, where there may be some controversy or maybe not, is that as a strategy of economic development, I believe that there are what I like to summarize as two pillars. One is health and education. That's no matter what country we're talking about or what level. Investing in people is a fundamental bulwark, not only a human right, but a sound economic strategy. You need healthy, educated people. But the second, you need economic growth. And I do believe that for a poor country, the best way to grow is to have diversified, rapidly growing exports, often by attracting American multinationals in, like Intel or others, to produce. I'm just explaining my difference. I told you it would be controversial. I just want to explain it. So just let me finish and just explain it. My observation is that in the countries that are successful in attracting such companies, that's actually where the growth is most successful. And the reason that countries don't get that is that sometimes the exports that would come from those firms are barred in the U.S. market. For instance, still in Africa today, they can't effectively export here textiles unless they're made in America. That's the protectionism. So that's one reason. And second, there are, you know, as I mentioned, a host of other reasons why countries don't get the investment, including their own mistaken policy sometimes of chasing out companies. So that's where we probably would not see eye to eye. You'd think it would probably, my guess is a lot of people here would think it would be a terrible thing to try to go after that investment. I just want to say my observation is
that the countries that have been successful in attracting such investment actually are the ones that have had the fastest growth.
Who in those countries benefits from that growth? Terrific
question.
That's a good question from the audience, done with direct action. And Jeffrey, you've got to get home to your kids. But
hang on.
Why don't you take it up and we'll let
I'm just going to get them to agree. This is one of the good things about debating economists, that we agree on certain things, okay? Now, foreign direct investment, you're arguing that it has a great benefit to and played a big role in China. But as a technical matter, they could do the same thing without the direct investment if they just licensed the technology or found a way to get the technology, right? They don't actually need the foreign ownership or direct investment itself unless they're actually using it to finance a trade deficit, whereas China has been running a trade surplus all these years. So if they're getting a benefit, if the foreign direct investment contributed to their growth in the way that you believe it did, and I would probably estimate a lot less than that, but if it did, it was through the transfer of technology. So economists and the World Bank and the IMF and everyone else should be pushing technology transfer rather than just foreign direct investment. And in fact, you would also agree that they're doing the opposite of promoting technology transfer by trying to tighten all the rules around intellectual property rights. Do we agree on that?
Let me say again, the IMF and the World Bank are terrible at attracting foreign direct investment, and I think the advice has been very bad. So neither organization has ever depended on actually attracting a dollar of real investment. And so I agree that, you know, it has not been a way to economic development. And I agree part with what Mark says, but I would put a bit of nuance on it, which is that I also favor technology transfer, and I think there are many ways to do it, but in practice, one of the most important ways is foreign direct investment. And I just saw, for example, in Costa Rica, I worked with the government in 1995-96 to help them attract Intel in an international competition where many countries were trying to get this plant. Intel was building a $1 billion semiconductor plant, and they were looking at different places. My thought was that it would be extremely good for Costa Rica to get it, so that Costa Rica wasn't dependent only on coffee or on bananas, but would also be selling semiconductors. They competed hard, they won the investment, they are a major semiconductor exporter right now. You could not transfer that technology. That is, they went beautifully to about the highest end production in the world markets, and they're doing hundreds of millions of dollars of exports through successful FDI, very clean energy, a very clean environmentally sound, very high-tech company in San Jose, and the results are quite good. In China, China's pulling in about $50 billion of foreign direct investment every year right now, which is the fuel of the long-term economic growth. It's been hugely successful. Malaysia is another country I would recommend you have a look at. Malaysia is a country that probably among the 12 world primary commodities is the one that did the best in moving out of that dependence on a few primary commodities to a diversified consumer appliances, electrical machinery, semiconductors, high tech in the last 30 years. And they did it by attracting Intel and others as well. So I think there is a record, and I'd love to spend, I hope you invite me back, because I'd love to do this when I didn't have to run. It's unfair, and it Jeffrey. Looks, and wait a minute, sorry. But I wanted to answer the question that was asked here. I think you asked, who was the beneficiary of this? Right. What I would ask you to do, what I would suggest, so you can be the judge, not me, a good place to look at the data is the Human Development Report each year of the United Nations Development Program, because they have the data in the back of the book
on life expectancy, caloric intake, maternal mortality, other very, very critical variables other than GNP per capita. I'm saying the real conditions of life. And the Human Development Report does a beautiful job in collecting those data. And they're available on the website, www.undp.org, or buying the thing. And what I'd ask you to look at is a case like China, or Malaysia, or these cases that I cited, to look at how dramatically rapid has been the improvement of life expectancy, reduction of infant mortality, and so forth. It's not uniform across the countries, but it is for hundreds of millions of people. It's about the most spectacular rise that you'll find. But anyway, I don't want to be the judge. I want you to look at the data. That's where I would suggest you find it. I do apologize.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Jeffrey Sachs.
Out the door.
Yeah, you're going to grab as you go.
As he runs and hears, the issue of China and Malaysia is a perfect example. Because if you look at the formula that folks are supposed to sign up for, China and Malaysia are the outriders. So the formula is, for instance, finance liberalization. But China and Malaysia control their currencies. So if you look at who survived the Asian financial crisis, it was the two countries in the region, China and India, who don't have freely convertible currencies. I mean, you can't speculate on the Chinese yuan. It's not traded. So the government is actually controlling that. That's one of the key sort of premises of the model. Look at the trade stuff. For Korea as well, these are countries that have very high import restrictions. There's still an 80% domestic content rule that the IMF is trying to chisel away in Korea right now for cars. So these are countries that have very protected imports. They did not allow imports, but they offered inexpensive labor, as this man back here points out, for companies to invest to export out. So they got investment, they got exports, but in fact, they protected their domestic markets. They had huge domestic public expenditures. Part of the formula is to cut down your domestic spending. I mean, in China, obviously, I mean, the energy sector, everything is the government. I mean, part of how the companies export successfully has to do with huge government-run sectors. And as far as technology transfer, I mean, basically, if you look at a lot of the success in countries like China, a lot of it has been in off the intellectual property rules transfer of technology, sort of like it or not. And frankly, let's be honest about this. This is what the U.S. did vis-a-vis Europe. When the U.S. was a developing country, we did technology transfer, we exported stuff but had very strict restrictions on imports, we had a very tight money policy, and this is the same technique that then Korea and other countries used, Japan, vis-a-vis the U.S. and Europe. And what the WTO's rules, the IMF's programs do is pull up all those ladders. And it does it in a way such that you see the countries that wouldn't buy the whole formula, like Korea, like Malaysia, who are the ones who A, grew the most, and B, have withstood the lumps. And so those two cases actually make the counterpoint, if you ask me.
Michael, last thing. Is the WTO pulling up all the ladders?
Yes.
In some sense, we're fighting last year's war. It is the economists at the World Bank who have written the devastating critique of the World Bank record and told us that the World Bank has an unblemished record of failure. It is the best and the brightest of the economic profession, Joe Stiglitz, who's a recent Nobel Prize winner, who's told us of the dreadful record of the IMF. By the way, it's interesting that Joe Stiglitz, who was chief economist of the World Bank, does not apply the same comment to the World Bank that he does to the IMF. Stan Fisher at the IMF will tell you how the World Bank has been dreadful, but the IMF has been just better. There's turmoil here by people whose hearts are in the right place and trying to figure it out. It is not simple how to get this stuff straight by any stretch of the imagination. Stan Fisher, who was head of policy for the IMF for years, was Africa's candidate to become head of the IMF. No one can question his intelligence is one of the best economists of the generation. No one can, I think, seriously question where his heart is and who he wants to help. There's profound questions about policy issues. In some sense, Lori, I find, is just picking on the worst part of the IMF, which almost the economic profession as a group has also condemned. The question is now what to do about it. There's a tremendous question about should the World Bank get out of the business of lending money, move to a grant system. That is to say, stop lending money to countries that can never pay the money back to create public service, public health structures that we know are going to be subject to corruption and be ineffective, and go to a system where the World Bank is just paying to get kids vaccinated. Let me pick up one, just a few nuggets from Jeff's comments. Jeff talked about strategies that he finds has worked some places, of an export-oriented strategy for growth and acceptance of foreign direct investment as a way of promoting technology transfer and productivity. Jeff can make that case. Believe me, nobody can reject that case out of hand. It's not nearly that subject to criticism. But let's be clear, in case it's not, that if some countries are going to grow by exporting, there are going to have to be some other countries that are importing. You can't just export in this world. There's got to be a system. And so therefore, you're led to the importance of trade liberalization, of pounding on the US and Western Europe to drop their barriers against agricultural and textile imports, against imports that mostly come from third world countries. Trade liberalization and the kind of exercise the WTO is engaged in has to be one. There are lots of things about the WTO you're not going to like. There are lots of things about the WTO that must be fixed. But just don't wave it and say, what a disaster. It's not that simple.
Vicky. Vicky, is trade liberalization a great hope for indigenous and poor peoples around the world?
Well, actually, that's also what I was going to say. Well, actually, we're not really saying that we are totally disregarding the WTO, that it's totally useless. And that's precisely why we have been studying all the different agreements under WTO and looking at how these agreements are really affecting different peoples in different countries. And what we are saying is that the problem with WTO is that, and even the IMF and the World Bank, is this: their policies is like a one-size-fits-all kind of policy, and it doesn't distinguish between the different developing stages of all the different countries in the world. And like, for instance, if we look at, as we have seen, China, that hasn't really used the IMF prescriptions of floating their currency, opening up financial liberalization, and really trying to develop their technology for processing products, then of course they will be able to grow that fast. But the countries which have really accepted all the requirements, the prescriptions of the IMF, like the Philippines, for instance, in spite of the fact that we have all the richest, the rich resources in the world, we have gold, we have silver, we have copper, we have everything, and yet we remain the poorest country precisely because we have been following all these prescriptions. And that's exactly why we're saying that, these kinds of prescriptions and the failure of the IMF and the World Bank in really bringing these countries into countries that are more progressive and economically more able to distribute wealth to their citizens. These kinds of prescriptions should already be removed, and the IMF should not keep on pushing these kinds of prescriptions to other countries. When will we ever see, up to now I haven't seen the IMF really changing its positions, changing its prescriptions in spite of all the failures, of which Argentina is the latest. We don't still see really a significant change in that. And the other point is, that's why this trade liberalization, of course it can be good for countries who really have the capacity to trade, and if there are the barriers to their exports are not there, and Malaysia is always cited as an example. I agree that it has really taken advantage of all the possibilities in trade, but again, we should not forget that Malaysia is not a World Bank country or an IMF country. And then the the point about trade liberalization is not something that will work for everybody. As I was saying, for instance, in our when you have a situation where developed countries, the richest countries, are able to put up barriers against products that are coming from developing countries, you know, and you have a situation where they can dump their products which are highly subsidized, you know, and highly subsidized domestically, and they are even given export subsidies, and they can sell those products at a much cheaper price than the products of local corporations, then of course you will have an economic crisis in that country, and that has been happening in many countries now. I mean, since WTO came into being, that is the story, for instance, in the Philippines, when many of our corn farmers lost almost 550,000 corn farmers in Mindanao, lost their livelihoods because cheap corn, highly subsidized corn, which came from Canada and the US, were dumped into the country and they were sold at 50% lower. Of course, they will say that it's because you are not efficient in your production, but is that the way that we should measure? I mean, you know, it's really very unfair. The whole trading system, as far as I'm concerned, which is abetted by the WTO, is so unfair to the developing countries. It doesn't really put a level playing field, as they would say, and those kinds of rules that are protecting the developed countries are the ones being put more into the WTO, more than the rules that are really disadvantageous for the developing countries. So that's precisely the battle in Seattle and in Doha, when developing country governments wanted that the implementation of the present agreement should be reviewed because this has caused a lot of problems for the developing countries. But instead of doing that, the developed countries came in and wanted to put more new agreements and put together a new round of agreements on foreign direct investment, competition, government procurement, and trade facilitation. That is not what the developing countries were asking for. And I think really what we should demand as citizens, especially for you who are here in the United States, is to really pressure your own government not to continue that kind of position, because if they really would like for peace, you know, and stability and development to reign in the world, those kinds of proposals are creating more violence, more instability, and therefore the problems that we have in relation to this, you know, that instability that we see in the world will never be resolved unless really the governments, the rich governments, will be able to come up with these agreements that will really give more favor to the developing countries. As they say, you know, we have been victims of colonization, you know, we have been victims of all these IMF and World Bank rules, and therefore we cannot in any way compete with the giants, with the developed countries who have developed very much because they colonized us.
To take my turn to be on straw man or straw person patrol, because I don't think we have basically chucked out the whole notion of multilateral trade rules or a system of rules. The movement is very internationally oriented and it's for fairness. And so just to pick up a report, we don't have time to go through it, but the International Forum on Globalization has a big, huge, honking, thick report coming out. This is the summary. It lays out as a system things that should be cut back, things that should be added, things that are missing, places to create more democracy, places to change the current institutions. It does, we're not just saying what we're against, we say also what we're for. And so I would ask people to take a look at this.